Hello, I'm Eric Corman, CEO of League of Education Voters and the parent of a high school junior of the global majority in the public school system who is accessing special education services. I advocate because of my son, so that every student can get what they need, when they need it, and how they need it. In this podcast, we interview students, policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create learning environments where every Washington student feels safe, supported, and a positive sense of belonging so that they can achieve academically and access the life they choose. John B. King Jr. served in President Barack Obama's cabinet as the 10th U.S. Secretary of Education. Over the course of his extensive and influential career in public education, he has been a high school social studies teacher, a middle school principal, the first African American and Puerto Rican to serve as New York State Education Commissioner, a college professor, and the president and CEO of the Education Trust, a national education civil rights organization. Secretary King is currently the chancellor of the State University of New York, SUNY, the nation's largest comprehensive system of public higher education. Both of his parents were career New York City public school educators. Secretary King's new book is Teacher by Teacher, The People Who Change Our Lives. Follow him on Instagram at John B. King Jr. and on X at John B. King. Secretary King, how did teachers change your life's trajectory?
Well, thanks for having me on. And really, if not for the teachers I had in New York City public schools as a kid, I don't think I'd be alive today. I grew up in Brooklyn. My mom passed away when I was 8, October 4th grade. You know, there are really no words to describe how devastating that was. At that time, I happened to be in the classroom of Alan Osterweil, who was my teacher in fourth grade. And then he ended up looping with us and staying with us in fifth and sixth grade, which was very unusual in the New York City schools of the time. During that period, I was living with my father. My father was much older and was sick with Alzheimer's, and nobody knew. It was just the two of us. And so home was incredibly scary and unstable and difficult. Some nights my father would talk to me. Some nights he wouldn't say a word. Some nights he'd be sad. Other nights angry, even violent. And the thing that saved me was Mr. Osterweil's classroom. It was a place that was safe and supportive and nurturing. We read the New York Times every day. We did productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespeare, in elementary school. We did a production of Alice in Wonderland, where I was the rose with big red felt petals sticking out of my head.
Wow.
We learned the leader and capital of every country in the world. It was like Miss Frizzle, you know, from Magic School Bus, brought to life. And his classroom really was a safe haven for me when home was so incredibly difficult. And so I was very blessed to have him as my teacher. In the years after, I just was fortunate to just have a series of educators who poured into me and gave me a sense of hope and purpose. And I'm so grateful for that.
That's huge. And I know it got difficult when you did get older, when you were in high school. I mean, at one point, you actually did get expelled. How did you reintegrate into the education system when that happened?
Yeah. My father got more and more sick, and then he passed away when I was 12. And after he passed, I moved around different family members, different schools, very unstable. I was angry as a teenager. You know, like many kids who've experienced trauma, I was angry at adults. I was angry at the things that happened to me. I had a growing awareness of injustice in society, and I was angry about that. And that anger was expressed through really rejecting adult authority. I got in a lot of trouble, got kicked out of school. At that point, went to live with my aunt and uncle. My uncle was my father's youngest brother. He was a Tuskegee Airman, one of the first Black pilots in the U.S. military. Spent a career in the Air Force, retired as a colonel. He ran a tight ship. So in Uncle Hal and Aunt Jean's house, dinner was at the same time every night. There was a lot of structure. That was very helpful for me to give me a sense of stability. And my uncle, you know, he had this conversation with me where he said, you know, I remember it so clearly, so vividly. He said, you know, neither you nor I can do anything about the things that happened to you as a kid. But now you have to decide what kind of man you want to be, what kind of life you want to have. And that was a really profound moment for me, you know, especially given the life that he had lived, the segregation he had overcome, his patriotism in the face of intense discrimination, his character. Hearing from him this charge to sort of step up was really powerful. And I was fortunate to go to a local public school where the teachers and the school counselor gave me a second chance. You know, they were willing to see me as more than the sum of my mistakes. And so that combination of Uncle Hal and Aunt Jean, the stability at home, which I hadn't had since I was 8, and teachers and a school counselor who had more hope for me than I had for myself, that helped me get back on track. It was such a blessing.
Yeah. And that's an incredible story and so wonderful that you had these caring adults, both at home and also in a school building. Is there a way to systematize that? You know, how important is it for students to have at least one caring adult in every school building?
I think it's everything. I mean, we really need to make sure that every young person has that adult that they feel connected to at school. I do think there are public policy choices that would allow us to systematize that. That's really what's driven my career. I became a teacher because I wanted to try to do for other kids what teachers had done for me. And as I've moved into policy and leadership roles, what I'm always thinking about is how do we make it so that it's not just a matter of luck? You know, for me, it was luck. It was lucky that I had Mr. Osterweil as my teacher at PS 276 in Canarsie. If I didn't have that, who knows how my life would have turned out? But it shouldn't be luck. It should be systematic. So one of the things we need to do is make sure there's a well-prepared, well-supported teacher in every classroom. We have to make sure that schools are places with wraparound supports for kids. For some students, that means after-school programs. For other students, that means getting meals at school. For some students, that means access to mental health services. For some students, that means access to supports for students with disabilities. But schools have to provide the full range of supports to really nurture students. And schools have to be laser-focused on student success. And that's not just academic success, right? And you and I have talked about this before. It's yes, academic success. That's necessary, but not sufficient. You have to be a student with solid reading skills and math skills to have access to opportunity, but that's not enough. You also need a set of socio-emotional skills, resilience, perseverance, a growth mindset, right? You also need exposure to science and social studies and the arts and a well-rounded education. You also need civic readiness and skills to participate in our democracy. There's a lot of things we want out of school, but those are the things we each want for our own children. So shouldn't we also want those for other people's children?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you talk about these different things, the soft skills, the human-centered skills. There's many ways of talking about it, the durable skills. Is there a way to accurately measure that? Because we do have our standardized testing for reading and math and science. But what could a system look like to measure those human-centered skills?
You know, when we were working on the Every Student Succeeds Act in the Obama administration, our hope was that by broadening the definition of educational excellence and inviting states to supplement English, math, science, high school graduation with additional measures, we would get more innovation around the country. And then, of course, the implementation of ESSA was derailed first by the Trump administration that didn't really prioritize it, and then COVID. So we haven't really seen that happen. But, you know, we have some really interesting things. One, we know that those soft skills, those socio-emotional skills, are often developed through hands-on learning, through working in teams, through working on projects. Well, where do we know that happens? It happens in career and technical education. So if a student is completing the training to be a pilot or a nurse, we know they're developing some of those skills. It's happening in international baccalaureate programs, in early college programs, where students are doing higher level work. They're doing research projects. They're writing research papers. They're doing science experiments and analyzing the work they've done. That gives you a fuller picture than just the tests would. We know that being in school matters, right? And chronic absenteeism is something we worry a lot about. If you're not in school, you're not going to build those relationships. So we ought to be paying attention to that. We know that some of those civic skills are developed through service. So if students are doing volunteer hours, as some states require, we then have a sense that they're actually getting a sense of community and contribution and what it's like to work next to someone who's different from them. So we've got work to do as a country, I think, to flesh out those broader metrics. It's not to say we don't have to care about English and math and science. We still need to care about those, but it's to know that that's not enough. We have to expect more.
Yeah. Are we measuring the right things? You know, that's what I go to. And I know for some of these pathways, like mastery-based learning and other things, the access to those programs is somewhat limited to students that are historically and systemically marginalized, students who identify as BIPOC, students who have disabilities, students experiencing homelessness, students in foster care, multilingual learners, students who have been involved in the juvenile justice system. How can we expand those opportunities for these students that often do have that background of trauma or have experienced trauma, like, unfortunately, you did as well? I mean, you know this from personal experience.
You know, I think one of the things is the resources, that oftentimes schools that are under-resourced struggle to provide that broad education that, again, we would all want for our kids. I think one step is to make sure that we have school funding formulas that are equitable. And equity means that we need more resources for students with disabilities, more resources for English learners. Not the same, more, because the needs are greater, right? So that's one thing that we need. A second thing that we need is belief, right? Because, you know, you think about the International Baccalaureate Program, recognized around the world, ask students to do rigorous, critical thinking and writing and research and analysis. And sometimes there's the assumption, well, that's for affluent students. No, that's something that all students can attain with the right supports. Whether it's low-income students, students of color, they can thrive in those environments. And some cities around the country have made very good progress scaling up IB programs. And even if not every student completes the IB diploma, it creates a different vibe in the school, if you will, if there's a lot more writing, a lot more research, a lot more experiments and projects being done. So belief is really important. And then the third thing I would say is equitable distribution of educator talent, teachers and principals. Too often, the schools serving the highest needs kids end up with the teachers who are teaching out of license. You know, they're teaching math, but they actually were trained as a social studies teacher. Or the emergency license teachers who actually haven't completed any training. They're just kind of thrown in, or they've completed very short-term training. They're just thrown in. That's not fair. That's not right. And it means students aren't going to get the kinds of experience that I had in Mr. Osterwile's classroom.
Teacher mindset, teacher talent, that's huge. I want to go back to mindset just for a minute, because often there is that belief gap, like you talked about. How can we shift mindset of educators so that educators would believe that every student can learn?
You know, a few things. One is we've got to get better at teacher preparation. Teacher preparation should look more like preparation to be a doctor. I think we should do more teacher residencies where teachers are really spending not just a few weeks doing student teaching, but spending a full year in the classroom of a master teacher, right? So they're seeing excellence in the classroom. And my experience, you know, across my career, I've been to many struggling schools. No matter how struggling the school, I've always had the experience that you walk through the door, there can be total chaos, students struggling academically, the school is not functioning well, but they will still tell you, you got to go to Mr. Corman's classroom. Right? And then you walk through that door and you're like transported into a totally different environment. Kids are focused, kids are working, kids are learning, kids are collaborating. The teacher has a warm rapport with students. And you think to yourself, wait, if this could happen in Mr. Corman's classroom, why isn't it happening in the rest of the building? So part of what we need to do is make sure that teachers who are being trained, our next generation of teachers, are in that classroom. They are seeing excellence in motion so that they can draw from those lessons when they become teachers. That's part of what shapes beliefs. You know, a second element, I think, is we need to work on educator diversity. We live in a very segregated society, and that segregation has a few consequences, one of which is that we have a lot of students who aren't seeing educators who are Black and Latino in front of the classroom. I had a friend who says, you know, if you have a Black teacher for calculus, you're a little less likely to be racist. Right? It's not 100%, but less likely. Because you're seeing this example of Black excellence, right, in your classroom. So for me, the teacher diversity thing isn't just for students of color, although we know that students of color really benefit from seeing folks who look like them in their school leading. But we also need white students to see Black and Latino educators leading. And so that, to me, is another part of how we shift the beliefs is to diversify the educator workforce.
Yeah, right there with you. I do have a question about post-secondary because obviously you spend a lot of time in the K-12 system. And now as chancellor of the State University of New York, you are rooted in higher ed. How is that experience for you different than working in K-12? You know, what do you see as the challenges and opportunities with higher ed?
Yeah. I mean, the amazing thing is, especially in public higher education, you're really serving as an engine of opportunity. Low-income students, first-gen students, veterans, single moms, for whom higher education is life-changing. It's unlocking incredible social mobility. That's really satisfying and very similar to K-12. Also very similar to K-12 is that you have to serve the whole student. So yes, it's the core academics, but it's also addressing food insecurity, housing insecurity, mental health needs, supports for students with disabilities, childcare needs, transportation needs. Like, yeah, think about all of it if you want to make sure that students are as successful as possible. The thing that I'm hopeful about is I think there is a broad realization, certainly amongst employers, that K-12 and higher ed, their success is essential to the success of our economy and ultimately our democracy. We're seeing now in New York State this program called SUNY Reconnect, where community college is free for adults 25 to 55 in high-demand workforce areas. Healthcare, advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity and IT, green jobs. It covers tuition, fees, books, and supplies. And it's amazing. It's life-changing for the students. But one of the things I've been struck by is employers love it because they desperately need folks with these skills.
Yeah.
And higher ed can provide that. We can deliver the workforce that they need. You know, I know there's a lot of polarization in our politics and a lot of attacks certainly on Ivy League institutions in particular. But I think there is actually behind all of that a broad bipartisan consensus that we need K-12 and higher ed to function well to deliver the future workforce. And that's a starting place for conversations about how we improve our systems.
Well, my son is 16. He's a junior in public high school. Mm-hmm. And just last night, he was having that conversation about, why do I need school? And what I've told him, at least the best answer that I have, is that school will give you options in life. You can make choices instead of just having one option. What else could we say to our kids to get them excited about the value proposition of public education?
Yeah. One of the things we have to do is help students see how school fits into their vision for their lives, right? So what are they passionate about? What are they excited about? What do they see themselves doing 5 years from now, 10 years from now? And how can we show them how school can enable that, right? You know, one of the things I worry about is, especially for low-income students, I mean, at the middle school level, they just don't know that many careers that are out there. They don't know that if you're really interested in healthcare, but you're grossed out by blood, there's actually a lot of jobs you can do. You can be an x-ray technician. You can be an insurance claims adjuster. Like, there's a lot of jobs, but they may not know that universe of jobs is available. So one of the things I think we need to get better at is in middle school and high school, exposing students to the range of careers and then helping them understand the schools that can get them there. We have a school within SUNY Maritime, where the students are prepared for careers in commercial shipping. Many will go into the Navy or the Coast Guard. Students are in uniform every day. Part of their educational experience is to go on a summer at sea on a training ship. Those students graduate into six-figure jobs, right? But I don't know that every student who grows up excited about the water knows that a maritime career is possible for them if they choose the right school. We have another school, SUNY Delhi, where students, we have a great vet tech program. If you love animals and you want to care for animals and you're passionate about that, being a vet tech, it's a great job. There's huge demand for vet techs around the country, especially post-COVID. A lot of people got COVID pets, right? So there's a huge demand. And those students are so excited about what they're doing. But does every student who really loves their dog, do they know that vet tech is even a career path that's available to them?
So I'm going to end with a vision question for you. You've mentioned a lot of changes you would make if you were in charge of our nation's education system. And I'm talking early learning, K-12, post-secondary, the entire continuum. Is there anything else you would do if you were in charge and you could wave a magic wand and there were no budgetary constraints?
Look, I would make the commitment that in the United States, college is going to be debt-free for all Americans. And that is achievable. We have the resources to do it. You start by doubling Pell Grants. That would take us a long way there. That vision that college can be accessible to everybody, I think would be a powerful driver, not only of greater success in higher ed, but I think also a motivator and create a shift in vision for K-12. If there was confidence that post-secondary education was available to everybody. Now, that doesn't have to be a bachelor's degree. That could be an associate's degree. That could be highly career-focused education. But knowing that that was available to all, I think would have a profound impact. So if there's no limit on the budget, I would do that. And then the other thing I would say is we need to get back to the idea that educational outcomes are a national imperative. We've lost that in recent years. I feel like we're a little bit adrift, you know? Student performance today is below where it was before COVID in reading and math. We should have our hair on fire about that. We have school districts where the chronic absenteeism rate is a third of students. I mean, that's brutal. But yet, we don't see people protesting in the street about that. We don't see the kind of urgency. So I think one of the things that I hope a future Secretary of Education brings is a restoration of a sense of urgency about delivering a quality education for every young person in America.
John B. King Jr.'s new book is Teacher by Teacher, The People Who Change Our Lives. Follow him on Instagram at John B. King Jr. and on X at John B. King. Secretary King, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. Great to talk with you.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to learn more about League of Education Voters or support our work, please visit our website, educationvoters.org.